Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
You're listening to Escape Adulthood with Kim and Jason. It's April 25th, 2008, and this is show number 30. On today's show, we interview Bob from Sesame Street. We ask him about how he became one of the original cast members and what it was like working with Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. We also talk about the effects of stress on children, an awesome retro tote bag, and dressing up like the characters from The Wizard of Oz.
Take me back to when I was a child, when everything was good enough, it was good enough for the wild. Coyote sleeps in the moonlight, rabbit goes by the day, snake winds around on a hot afternoon, and eagle flies on his way. Take me back now if you can. Take me back now to the land where the people sleep in the moonlight, the children run in the daylight, and that feeling never dies, but it may go away for a while.
Welcome to the Escape Adulthood podcast show, your number one source for long-lasting, fast-acting, physician-approved adultitis relief. This is Jason with my wife Kim saying hi from Studio 315 in Madison, Wisconsin. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to podcast@kimandjason.com or giving us a call at 608-554-0803. Well, it's a beautifully rainy day here in Madison, Wisconsin,
yes,
which is fine by me.
Definitely April showers bring my flowers. We're getting lots of showers.
Yes, we will see. And I'm just happy that we don't have the snow. So it's nice to be into spring and the weather is getting good and the birds are chirping and
grass is green.
Grass is green and flowers are blooming and you can't get much better, I tell you.
Spring in Wisconsin is wonderful.
That is right. So we have a big show today.
It's huge. Number 30.
Number 30. We had to celebrate in grand fashion, so we got a hold of Bob from Sesame Street.
The Bob.
The Bob.
The Bob that everyone grew up with,
many
right?
of you listeners have probably, grew up with him, watched him on TV. The interview was so good, so long. This is actually going to be a two-part show.
Yeah.
So we'll have part of the interview this month, rest of it next month. You guys are in for a real treat. It was a lot
awesome.
Of fun chatting with them.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
So let's get into the show. We got a lot of stuff to cover. Well, we'll start things off with the mind bender, and I figured it would be good to go with the Sesame Street theme since we're talking to Bob today. Okay, here it is. What color was Oscar the Grouch in the first episode of Sesame Street?
Ooh. Well, obviously, he must not be green, because that would be a really weird question. Oscar the Grouch, the first episode. I'm going to say blue.
Blue.
Yeah, because was Grover blue?
Yes, Grover was blue.
There's some other blue Muppets, so I'm going to go with blue.
Okay, well, we'll reveal the answer at the end of the show, so stay tuned. Well, we've got some feedback to share on this episode. First one, we're going to start off with an audio feedback that we got from a fellow by the name of Chris Hinton. He called us all the way from Scotland to leave a little message, so here it is.
Hi, guys. This is Chris Hinton from Scotland, the winner of your latest Swell giveaway. I just phoned up to say thanks very much, and I'm really enjoying the podcast. Keep up the good work, and I'm looking forward to hearing the next episode. Take care, guys.
So that was a nice little message from Chris, a Club K&J member from across the pond. So that was very nice.
Yeah, so it's always fun to hear people's voices. So thanks, Chris. We appreciate your call.
And if you'd like to leave us a message, again, the number is 608-554-0803. We may just play it on our next show. We also got an email from a person named Joanne. I don't know if it's Joanne or Joanna.
I don't know.
But here's the email. I just wanted to write to you both to say this was the first podcast of yours that I have ever heard. And how fitting. I wanted to let you know how prevalent work rage really is. You remember our last show, we talked a little bit about work rage.
That's right.
I am a sergeant in corrections and a female to boot. It is very frustrating on a daily basis to work with folks that don't have the same work ethics as I do, don't take their job seriously, or simply don't care in general, and are only there for a paycheck. Believe me, taking breaks and having lunch isn't enough to battle the rage. It may help a bit, but in some professions it just isn't the answer. I have been in this field for over 11 years, and until recently I have not had a position where taking a lunch was ever possible. We have never been afforded that luxury. We ate when we could squeeze it in, and breaks? Ha! So when surrounded literally by negativity, both from the inmates and from Slack, as you put it, Jason, co-workers, and an insurmountable amount of work that has to be done every day, it just gets to be too much. In the corporate world, you can take a break, or you can talk to the boss and try to get some relief. But in reality, in my world, that simply isn't an option. Any adultitis suggestions for this epitome of negative work environment? On a lighter note, she says, I discovered your website entirely by accident, and I just wanted to let you know how fun. I have pored over the site, laughed at lots of the content, and I plan to purchase your lighthearted and inspirational artwork for my office and postcards for my friends. Thank you so much for this levity. Keep up the great work, kids. Joanna. Well, that was a very nice email, yeah. Of course. I don't know. For me, I would say in regards to her question about suggestions for her negative work environment, I guess the obvious one is if the environment is that negative, then maybe you should consider a career change. Just that would be in
soul searching, you know, yeah.
One thing. Now, obviously, certain jobs she may like the actual work she does, right. Just the environment is not that good. So I guess for me, if there's really nothing she can do about her boss and being able to talk to the boss to make any changes, then I guess the only other option is to make sure that you're getting as much adultitis treatment outside of work. Mm-hmm. So making sure you're spending time doing fun things, surrounding yourself with positive people to kind of offset the negative effects that are going on at work.
Definitely.
Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I would say also that, you know, a lot of our reality is kind of in our head. And so if she can try to have some fun, you know, in her own mind throughout the day, whether it's trying some of our escape plan challenges or just trying to be positive and bring some of that positive energy into the negative environment around her, that will make a difference. It may mm-hmm. seem like, you know, insignificant, like it's not going to do anything, but it's all kind of what's your view and how are you looking at things, and, right. and maybe that will kind of
and to be able to have that energy, because at the beginning it may be just sucked right out of her,
right?
That's where you have to be filled up on the outside and
exactly.
make sure that you have that recharge going on as often as you can.
Yeah, well, keep us posted, Joanne, and thank you for the email.
Yes. So, yeah, if any of you would like to send us an email, feedback, questions, anything like that, the email address is podcast@kimandjason.com. And, of course, the phone number again is 608-554-0803.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
Good evening. Here is the news for Paris.
I look good. I mean, really good.
Hey, everyone! Come and see how good I look!
In the news from The Telegraph in the UK, 1 million children mentally ill through stress. More than 1 million children have disorders ranging from depression and anxiety to anorexia, a report is expected to claim this week. The fifth in a series of 6 reports by the Children's Society into the state of childhood is expected to disclose that pressures on the young to grow up too quickly are leaving increasing numbers with mental health problems. Binge drinking, drug taking, and pressures to look fashionable and attractive are all said to be contributing to the trend. Ross Hendry, head of the public policy at the National Children's Home, said, "From our own services, we know that support must be in place. Not just the child, but the whole family must be at the center of the support to truly tackle the issues at stake." Yikes. 1 million children.
Well, I'll tell you my take on this. I think that most, probably a lot of people who hear that, the idea of growing up too quickly, people might chalk that up to growing up with a single parent or maybe in poverty circumstances or some sort of tragedy like that. And I got to tell you that I'm sure that's part of it, but a lot of it is probably from middle to upper class, well-to-do families. Because here's the deal. We have parents that are signing their kids up for all kinds of activities. They're pressuring them to get good grades in school so they can get into good high schools, good colleges, all this sort of thing. And even though it may seem like it's for their best interest, it's this sense of keeping up with the Joneses that is, the kids are picking up on that. They're like sponges. And so there's this like feeling that, you know, they've got to be really keep pushing themselves to amount to everything. And meanwhile, they don't have the time to just play and imagine and do their own thing. And it's a lot of pressure on kids. And like I said, it's one of those things that maybe it doesn't, from the surface, it doesn't look like these parents are really doing this in a negative, for negative reasons, but it can have very negative effects.
Definitely. Well, I know our niece, who's in fifth grade, I mean, she's one of the only kids in her class that doesn't have a cell phone of her own.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she gets made fun of. And that's just ridiculous, you know? And to think of kids binge drinking and taking drugs, it's like, why would a kid need to take drugs? Well, because they're feeling some sort of pressure.
Right.
And where does that come from? Well, it's not rocket science.
And I think, you know, we could also throw in the media there to blame in terms of, you know, you got to look a certain way, you got to act a certain way, you got to have certain things to be cool or to whatever. And that's, that definitely takes the blame. But again, it comes down to the parents. Does your kid have a TV in the bedroom? Are they watching whatever shows they want to watch? Are they being absorbed with all of this information that's just adding to this pressure? So
yeah,
the family, all of our problems could be solved if it just always goes back to the family. So that's my take.
Yeah, definitely. I would say number one thing you can do if you think this might be inching into your life is make sure you're doing that family dinner. That's our biggest thing that we talk about, is
that central time to get together on a regular basis to just be together away from all of the craziness of the world.
Yep.
Okay, so it's time to roll this interview that we had with Bob McGrath of Sesame Street. This is going to be the first half of it. So we'll just get right into it. How's that sound?
Sounds good. Enjoy.
We are very pleased to have with us today Bob from Sesame Street. Bob McGrath just celebrated his 38th year on Sesame Street and has bridged two generations of viewers as one of the original hosts. In addition to his role as the music teacher, or Pied Piper of Sesame Street, he is an award-winning recording artist, concert performer, and successful author, writing both children's books and music curriculum. Bob has performed thousands of family pops, educational and holiday concerts for audiences who are now bringing their children, or sesame seeds, to see and hear their friend Bob. Bob, we are so excited to have you here today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Yeah, there's just so much we have to ask you, so we're going to just jump right in. And the first question we have for you, Bob, is share with us the influence your family had on you in regards to the direction you chose throughout your career.
Well, I guess, you know, if it wasn't for my mom, who was very musical, she played piano and so forth, and getting me sort of out of the starting gate singing at 5 years old at every function imaginable, weddings, PTA meetings, and everything. I was singing at the Roxy Theater in Ottawa when I was five.
Wow.
I probably never would have followed, you know, that sort of musical path. That was all from my mom. My dad was actually totally tone deaf, but he was very encouraging for my singing.
I can relate to that.
You're good with a pencil, though, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I think the wonderful thing is that I had two brothers and two sisters, and they were very encouraging and allowed us to all kind of follow whatever path we decided to do. And we had a great, great support from, it was a very loving family, and I feel very fortunate for that. And that included, you know, when I'm thinking back now, a lot of these, I haven't thought about some of these things, but there wasn't a lot of money to go around, but there was never any comment about having to pay for voice lessons and piano lessons mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing. So so I think I was very fortunate to have had that possibility brought, you know, that availability at a very early age. I probably didn't have any idea at that time that I was going to end up in this profession. In fact, that came much, much later. But it was all a good starting point for me.
It's so huge. Yeah, go
but
ahead.
I'd say my mom was, you know, my first experience, she was playing the piano. We had inherited an old upright piano from my grandmother, and she was playing, and I went in and sang along with her one day, and by the time my dad came into the field, I had learned my first song, which I think was in the good old summertime, and sang for him at lunchtime during this field break. So that was my very first performance. So unlike I never sang for my father. I did sing for my father at five. So.
Wow.
It's so great to be able to have just that openness with your family to encourage you guys, whatever paths you wanted to take.
Absolutely.
That's so important.
I remember my father had hoped my older brother, 10 years older, would help him run the farm, and he did help him for a while, and then he came one time and he said, you know, I've just been up and down this field once too many times, I'm off to college. So, and he said, okay, fine. You know, there's never any pressure to stick around and have him help.
What a blessing. So
yep.
From a previous conversation, we discovered that you grew up without a TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were wondering how did you go from having no TV, which was fairly common in those days. I mean, it's not, you know, crazy or anything, but how did you then end up working on one of the most popular children's shows of all time?
Yeah.
Could you give us a little bit of a nutshell of how that whole journey came to be?
I had a lot of strange transitions. Actually, we not only did not have a TV growing up, we didn't have electricity.
Wow.
So not till I was 6 years old, and that's when... that's when Roosevelt got electricity in a lot of the farms. So our form of entertainment then, television wasn't even in the back of anyone's mind at that point. We did have radio, and that was a great source of entertainment, from Jack Benny to Captain Midnight and the Green Hornet, and those radio shows, you know, really required a lot of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was something, I don't know, this is in retrospect, thinking that when I first saw some of the early test pieces done by Jim Henson before being hired in Sesame Street, I think that sense of imagination might have carried through, and I saw what an incredible imaginative kind of person he was. As for Sesame Street, you know, how did I get from there to there? I first heard about it from a college friend, bumped into him in front of Carnegie Hall, and he had just come off the Kangaroo Show, and I was just coming off kind of a heady three-year tourings of Japan for 3 years. And when he told me if I'd be interested in the show, I said, in auditioning for a new children's show, I said, no, not in the least. So showed you how much I knew even then. And but then when I saw some of the early test pilots going on for animation and film and so forth, and from this guy called Jim Henson that I'd never heard of, I realized this was going to be a really important show, and then I worked as hard as I possibly could, and passed the five pilot shows. Three out of the four of us survived those, and those were based on the reactions of five-year-old kids watching the show on closed UHF channels around the country, and then you know, that all got started. But so I've been eternally grateful to five-year-olds ever since, because that's really how I got my job. But anyway, I guess you know, maybe not having a television, back to your question, was a positive experience that kind of helped develop a child's imagination when everything isn't put so exact, you know, right in front of your eyes. You really do have to use your imaginations, and that's probably one of the most valuable skills as you can help teach a child is using their imagination, I've always felt.
That's great advice.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And, you know, I think, you know, certain people growing up with Sesame Street and all that, you kind of have an idea of, you know, the characters and all that. But what would be something that most Sesame Street fans would be surprised to know about you or even about the show itself?
Well... in terms of the show, I think one thing that when I discuss it with people, I think one of the things they're always surprised about is that there was almost 2 years of really intensive research before the first show was ever aired in 1969, and that now 39 years later, some 4,000 shows later,
wow,
there's that same dedication to researching every element in the show. And they're also surprised to learn that we have a worldwide audience, that the English version is in over 120 English-speaking countries and over 20 co-productions in foreign languages, from Bangladesh to China and South America. And there are a lot of humorous things, like in France, there's Le Rue Sesame and Cookie Monster is Le Macaron. You know, so it's kind of fun hearing. I was once chased around Paris one time by a group from France, and they... And they, in the early years, they used to dub us in whatever language before they were up and running to their own production. And so they all started speaking fluent French to me,
of course,
which I didn't speak. But fortunately, they were fluent in English, so we were able to communicate. But it was funny. They thought I was fluent in this has happened in several languages. Well, people will start talking to me in that language, just assuming that I knew how to speak it. So.
That's your dubbed voice, right?
Yeah, all dubbed in.
Wow, that's funny.
That's pretty. Yeah, it's probably I bet quite amazing when you see a show like that that appears so simple,
mm-hmm.
but that's really with anything. Most things that appear very simple actually have a lot of thought into there to try to get it to be that simple, that clear, that effective. So that's
no question. I'm sure that, you know, as simple as a strip cartoon is, I'm sure an enormous amount of thought goes into those four or five little captions, right?
Yep, I mean, every word, every line matters when it's when you don't have much to work with. So
and you have to really, it's almost like writing a haiku poem every day.
Yep.
You know, you have to really minimize it down to get a thought across and the fewest words possible, right?
Yep, that's a great analogy.
Yeah.
So your resume is quite extensive. We touched a little bit on it so far. You've toured mm-hmm. Japan. You've sang with Mitch Miller. You sat across the desk from Johnny Carson and worked with Jim Henson. And so looking back on things, what would you say is one of your highlights? What would be an experience or opportunity that instantly brings a smile to your face after all of these years of all the interesting experiences?
There's a whole lot of them, including, you know, a child meeting me after a concert and saying, a little five-year-old girl out in Vancouver saying, I loved your concert, Bob, and I said, thank you, and then kind of pulling me down and whispering in my ears, but you know something? I said, what's that? And she said, up close, you don't look too good.
You
know? So that always is kind of a nice leveling. I've had, you know, dozens and dozens of those little tidbits. But I guess thinking back, I think one thing that always kind of amuses me is the idea of being Babu Magulash in Japan for 3 years, 9 or 10 trips. And thinking back, opening in my concerts, I did a lot of concerts and television recording, and opening my concert, the second half of my concert with another musician playing a shakuhachi, that's a bamboo flute, and both of us in full kimono and gaitas and being asked to sing in old Japanese folk songs in Japanese, also for... We got an invitation from the Prime Minister Sato one time to go over and do the same thing with he and with his bamboo flute and me with myself and singing at a private, entertaining a few of his close friends, you know, over sake and dinner. And it always kind of, even now, struck my Illinois farmer funny bone for an Irish tenor. You know, to be singing "Daddy Boy" in Japanese, either to the Prime Minister or on the Johnny Carson show. You know,
wow.
As well as on "To Tell the Truth." I somebody just found that old clip I'd forgotten about, but was on "To Tell the Truth" and ended up singing "Daddy Boy" there. That's a really fun remembrance. Then I think the other thing that I find rewarding, maybe it brings a smile and rewarding both, is having the opportunity over the last 39 years to have done hundreds of symphony orchestra, family pops concerts with symphony orchestras, and having had the opportunity to bring a live symphony orchestra to thousands of kids and their parents, many of them for the very first time, and having them hear live musicians as opposed to something recorded or just on their iPod, because there's a very big difference between that kind of a situation. And I know a lot of times parents can come and say, you know, it's the first time I've ever heard a symphony orchestra, and it really is not as bad as I thought it might be, you know. so that's really nice. We've done, within my Pops concerts, I'll often include classical pieces like the Planets by Gustav Holst with a narration and slideshow projections, and another wonderful piece by Prokofiev called Lieutenant Kesia, and a lot of classical pieces that I've either sung, not so much sung, but I'll do narrations to them and find interesting ways to inject classical repertoire into a otherwise, you know, Pops concert from Sesame Street and some from my recordings and so forth. So that's always been kind of rewarding, and that's fun. Also, I was thinking back, you know, just remembering some of the wonderful moments taping like songs like Sesame Street and The People in Your Neighborhood, which kind of became my signature song, and especially doing almost every occupation imaginable with Frank Oz and Jim Henson. And they had a great sense of humor, and they were just absolutely incredible to work with and watch them work. And we always pre-recorded the track, and just before I had to sing, "Oh, the baker is the one who makes," or whatever it might be, they would always throw in, you know, a gag line, a bad pun, and they'd change every, if we had to do two or three or four takes, they always managed to come up with a different punchline each time, attempting to crack me up just moments before I had to start singing. So at the time it was nerve-wracking because, you know, you're taping the thing live and you don't want to blow a take, but that was fun. But and I think also some of the reaction that kids have had over the years, like one of our favorite stories that came in a letter from Mom early on, and this has to do with kids discovering things and how wonderful it is to help kids learn to discover. And she came running into the room early one morning screaming, "Mommy, Mommy, my pillow." And she said she and her husband sat bolt upright and said, "What is it?" And the little girl said, "It's a, my pillow." And they said, "What is it?" She said, "It's a rectangle." You know? So she had just discovered for the first time in her life that her pillow was a rectangle. And it's wonderful to think that, you know, the show has brought some of that sort of discovery into kids' lives. And it's always great when, you know, parents or teachers can do that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's cool. I have to go back. You had mentioned Frank Oz, and I didn't realize he was involved in Sesame Street. I don't know if Kim, you probably don't know, he's the guy who brought Yoda to life in Star Wars.
Oh, very much so.
And so I didn't realize he was also involved, although I guess I remember.
On Sesame Street?
Yeah.
Oh, no, quite the contrary. I mean, the first, before, at the very germ of Joan Cooney's idea of Sesame Street, she was aware of Jim Henson's talents in the Henson Company, and that was one of the first elements that she put in place before anything else went ahead, is that he was going to be a very integral part of the whole show. Mm-hmm. And he and Frank had already been working together for quite a long time. I mean, okay. They were amazing team. Mm-hmm. And that's a team that's never been replicated in terms of our show. We have individuals that are, you know, that are tremendously talented, but they spun their humor and ideas and creativity off on each other all the time. So he was very responsible. I mean, all the Bert and Ernie pieces were all okay. Frank and Jim. And
wow.
Those are like classic Abbott and Costello pieces.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Now, did those guys do the voices as well as the puppetry? Or was
in every case, the puppeteer not only has to manipulate the puppet, but has to create and do the voice at the same time, because the personality of the voice and the manipulation of the puppet, or the Muppet to be more accurate, is integral. So Big Carol Spinney is Big Bird inside Oscar, is inside Big Bird and inside Oscar and Frank and Jim, and every puppeteer has to create their own. It would almost be impossible to do it otherwise, because the manipulation of the hand and the whole puppet has to be so synced with, you know, the vocal thing. As a matter of fact, it always struck me funny when we haven't been doing this lately, but in the early years when we did some cast albums and the cast and all the Muppeteers were in a large studio doing a cast album together, it was interesting to see Frank and Jim and any other puppeteer, even while they're singing without the puppet, they would very often have their arm extended and their hand over, manipulating their hand while they were singing, because it was such a tight bond union between the voice and the manipulation of the puppet.
That's very
interesting.
Isn't that
fun?
Wow,
that yeah.
Now, since we're talking about the different Muppets and characters, do you have a favorite Sesame Street character that you would?
It's hard to separate the person.
Okay.
We've become very good friends, and Carol Spinney and I have been very close friends for a long time, and he of course does both Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. And in early years, the show has changed quite a bit in the last 4 or 5, 6 years, because our target audience is now much, much younger than it was. So the show is constructed differently now for our target audience, is sort of 0 to 3 instead of 4, 5, and 6 at this point.
Wow.
So we have to do different kinds of productions. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
It's a little less interesting than it was in the early years in some respects. But we had so many, especially with Oscar and myself, we were really the odd couple, and I got suckered into every one of his cheap tricks he ever came up with. And, you know, I never, ever learned, no matter how many times I got suckered in with his magic spoon, which eventually got going too fast and splattered chocolate pudding all over my whole face. But anyway, so I really enjoy Carol with Big Bird and Oscar. Because of our personal relationship and the hundreds of pieces we did together. But I also just absolutely love Grover, especially as the waiter with Mr. Blue, the blue guy. And waitresses all over the country. So I'll go in there and say, tell Grover we know exactly how he feels. Aww. I just had a customer like that last night in my booth, you know. And then, of course, Kevin Clash as Elmo and as... Mm. Hootsie Owl and any number of other is absolutely brilliant. So I have tremendous respect for Kevin Clash. He's just really one of a kind. And way before Jim passed away, Henson, he put Kevin in charge of the Muppets when he was too busy doing feature films and the Muppet Show in England and so forth. So those are kind of my favorites, I guess.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I love Grover and Big Bird and Oscar. And
I was always a big fan of... the obscure character Guy Smiley.
Guy Smiley was great.
Yeah.
We've lost some good people, including the fellow that did Guy Smiley, as well as Jim Henson and our two most creative musical people, Joe Raposo and Jeff Moss, and of course our principal writer, director, executive producer, one of the main group of four or five that started the show is John Stone. So we've lost a lot of really, really good people over the years.
But what a great legacy you guys have left, though, all that work, and it's just, you know, touching, continues to touch
people. It's interesting, you know, this is a little off the track, and I promise to keep it short, but Einstein, you know, his whole idea of imagination and so forth, and I've often thought it was Joan Cooney's sense of imagination, knowing that there were a lot of inner city kids who were being, Head Start funds were being cut right around the late 60s, which was why she had the idea of doing this show, to help bring especially inner city kids up to speed of middle and upper income kids. And the germ of that idea, you know, that sense of imagination has in sense, as Einstein spread all around the world, he said, you know, the quotes, imagination is more important than knowledge, because knowledge is limited, but imagination encircles the world. And in a sense, Sesame Street has encircled the world now.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, you know, as we're talking about all the different lessons, what important life lesson do you think you've learned from the kids that you've worked with over the years on Sesame Street and in your performances? Because I know there's a lot of interaction with different kids on the actual show. Is there any important life lesson that stands out to you from your interaction with them?
Well, there's a lot of them. Some you get from your own children, your own grandchildren, in general, I guess, you know, if we could all be a bit more childlike, and not that doesn't mean being childish, we'd probably live a happier and more productive and fruitful life. Many, as we talked about, you know, kids, I think, have a wonderful innate sense of discovery, which we talked about, and if that's been nourished in their early years and they're open-minded and open to helps them to be open-minded, open to all kinds of new and wonderful ideas. The discovery of the pillow is an idea, is a thought there.
Yeah.
And I think if a kid is fortunate enough to have been raised with love and encouragement in everything they do, they can develop that sense of discovery and imagination. And as a parent now, maybe as a grandparent with eight grandchildren, I have a little more time, not much, to think about these things, but I think if you can help a child develop, you know, great imaginations and a sense of self-esteem, that's probably the best gift you can possibly give a child. Because if you feel good about yourself, whether it's, you know, whether you're 5 or 50 or 98, you're gonna start the day on a different tack than you would if you didn't feel good about yourself. So I think that's terrific, and we're babysitting our 2.5- and 5-year-old grandsons this week because it's school's off and my daughter's busy and so forth. And just seeing the 5-year-old, he's totally into fire engines and a fire truck, and he said, I want to build a fire truck, and he showed me a picture of a very complicated fire truck, and he said, I want to build this one. I said, yeah. I said, well, it's kind of hard, and he said, no, it's not, and he just took off and said, all you have to do is this and this and this and this and this and this, and we'll have a fire truck. And I said, okay, I don't know how it's going to end up, but, you know, I've started cutting some wood up. So, but, you know, it was like he could have said, you know, I'm going to build a nuclear reactor this afternoon, and I can do it.
One step at a time.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
That's awesome.
Is. And I have to say that you would be, like, the coolest grandpa ever.
Well, sometimes I'm a little more strict than I have to be on Sesame Street.
Yeah, that's true. And, which is important. That's just as important as the fun, you know, at that age.
It is fun. My kids, you know, are all at different ages when they were. Michelle was growing up, but I think the one that was another thing that brings smile to my face, remembering back to my face, is one time I came home, and my youngest daughter was about 3-ish, and she was sitting and watching the show, and I happened to be on the show at that point, just closing the show. And I walked in, and she had her back to me, looking at the TV, and I said, hi, Kathleen. And she did about literally 3 or 4 double takes from the screen to me. And then jumped up over the back of the couch and without even stopping for a second just leapt at me, assuming I was going to catch her. And then she started beating me on my chest and pointing to the thing. She said, that's my daddy, that's my daddy. You know? I don't know who she thought I was, but and that was a few days later, I walked out of the house just as he had closed the show, saying, you know, Sesame's been brought to you today by the so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And I finished, and I turned off the set, and I walked out the front door, at which point a little boy 2 doors down was coming down the sidewalk on his scooter. And he was about 5-ish, and he just practically came to a screeching halt in front of our door, and he said, boy, are you fast. He assumed I'd managed to get from Sesame Street to Francis Street in a millisecond.
Wow.
It was like a time warp for him, I guess.
Did your kids ever ask you if you could bring like Big Bird or Bert and Ernie home for dinner any time like that?
Well, not really, but what I did want to do early on, because it was a bit of a problem for Matt Robinson, who was the original Gordon on the show, because he actually lived in Philadelphia and commuted. And his children were young, and they'd turn on the show and see he and Susan as husband and wife for, you know, 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a very confusing thing for them.
I bet.
And difficult. And I wanted to make my job, because my kids were different ages. The youngest ones were fine and dandy. The ones that were in 4th, 5th grade or so when the show started, they got a lot of flack from their friends at school because it was not cool if you were 12, 13 to be watching, quote unquote, they called it a baby show.
Right.
And they'd say, you know, so big deal, your father can count up to 10, right? You know. So they had to sort of figure out how to deal with all of that. So what I did do, and I wanted to make it like, you know, I go to work like anybody, and it's my job. It's not the star time thing. I did take each of them to the show once or twice just to kind of get to know everybody and see. It was a long 8, 9, 10, 11-hour day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so they got a pretty good sense of who I was and the reality of everything. And I think they realized. And I had them on the show just once, but some cast members have used their children in the show. I found that I didn't really want to do that because it's hard to concentrate on what you're supposed to be doing and making sure your kid's not, you know, poking a Muppet in the eye, which my 3.5-year-old did with Ralph. She kept looking down, trying to look inside his mouth where his hand was, you know. And it's hard to remember lines when your kid is acting up, though.
I
didn't
imagine.
Do that.
Yeah, that's
interesting. But it was fun.
So this kind of, I think, ties into the, you know, the little boy in the scooter seeing you and thinking you got home so fast.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you started the show, Sesame Street was an idea. You know, Jim Henson was a relative unknown, wasn't really that big of a deal. What was the point that you realized that Sesame Street had become a pretty big deal? Was there a moment for you that you're like, wow, this is really something?
Well, I think there were a few moments. It wasn't just, you know, an epiphany all at once kind of thing. But when I finally did get the second call a couple of months after I said, no, I'm not the least bit interested in being in a children's show, much to my, you know, whatever. And I was called in a couple of months later, and they said, come on in and take a look at some of the early animation and film and so forth. I think I got an inkling that this was going to be a really different kind of show at that moment, and that's when I decided I was going to do everything I possibly could to be a part of it. And then as the show started getting aired, we started getting some really good feedback from our folk station around the country. We had outreach people, probably four or five or six of them in different parts of the country, especially where inner city and low income kids, because we wanted to make sure that they knew there was such a thing, A, as PBS, because it wasn't a very important station in many respects at that point. And they wanted to let them know that this show, Sesame Street, existed. We even had people down in the hoots and hollers and in the South going up and fixing television antennas on individuals' homes so they could actually get the show. I mean, that's how that's how thorough they worked in terms of getting the word out. And we started getting good feedback from those folks that are working with our target audience several months into the first broadcast season. Early reviews were positive, but I think maybe for several of us, the first summer, I guess it was the first summer or off when we were not taping, we toured many major inner city areas, including Watts and Jacksonville and Chicago. And I remember one out in Watts, there were the four original cast members and Big Bird, and Oscar was what went out. And we went out, and there must have been, I'm sitting in the lawn out in Watts in a big park, like 3,000 kids or so. Wow. It was like a little mini Woodstock, you know. And when Big Bird appeared, half the kids had already bought their Big Bird doll, and it was like, you know, it was like a Rolling Stone concert, and they were all thrusting their birds up over the top of their head and screaming and everything, and that was pretty exciting, and we had a feeling we were really on the right track when we saw the action for the first time live from the kids. And then the other thing was, along the way, was the response from parents, but especially, as I said, our inner city parents and teachers, that, you know, of how we really were in fact reaching our target audience and what an impact it was making on kids who were coming from really tough home life situations and were at a disadvantage, you know, educationally and so forth. So those were all kind of times it took us a while. None of us had any idea we were going to be on the air, you know, for 39 years. We're now preparing for our 40th season.
Wow.
And to be, as I said, all around the world in, you know, 20 different foreign languages. That's nothing anyone ever could have anticipated.
Man, what a storyteller, huh?
Yeah.
Just a great, just enthusiasm for life and
I could listen to
interesting
him for hours.
Perspective, yeah. Mm-hmm. So just a reminder, again, that was just part of the interview. We'll have the second half next month in our next podcast, and we'll pick it up right where we left off.
Today, one of these lucky contestants will win his or her weight in fish. Right here on
Wheel of Fish! Oh, goody, goody! I've done a good thing, and I get a prize!
We have a $20 gift certificate to give out this month.
Yeah.
Well, what last episode we talked to Jason and Jody Womack about time-saving tips and time management and all that. And so we asked the question to all of the listeners, what is your favorite time-saving tip? And the winner we picked out for this month was Jillian Gaudio. So what did she write, Kim?
Jillian wrote, my favorite time-saving tip is to plan out all the things I need to get done in my planner. That way in the morning, I get everything done right away so I have a free afternoon. I even plan time for a movie. Tomorrow is Finding Nemo. Each day, that way I know I'll have some quiet time. every day.
Very good. Very simple, but
yeah,
you know, that's just it. If you get the important stuff done and get it all planned out, you're good to go. It's those little time stealers that creep in and make you feel like you've had a busy day when you really haven't accomplished anything.
Right. You end up checking your email about 20 times a day, which really could have done it twice.
Not so good.
No.
So we're going to do it again. So we're gonna get out a $20 gift certificate to Jillian. And this month we have another question. Who is your favorite Sesame Street character?
Yeah.
And why?
Ooh.
Okay. So don't just say Bert. We want to know why Bert. What's so big about Bert, right? So send us your email. You could leave a message, too, if you want a phone message, to podcast@kimandjason.com or give us a call at 608-554-0803. And we will pick someone out and give them a $20 gift certificate to the Kim and Jason Lemonade Stand.
Welcome to kimandjason.com.
Supply of misinformation is Mr. Know-It-All.
Our latest magazine is hitting the newsstands, the virtual newsstands, I guess. it's on its way to Club K&J members as we speak.
Yeah.
What is it, our fourth issue?
Yes.
And we had an interesting cover shoot, didn't we?
Yes, this was pretty fun. Well, the theme was kind of talking about passion and having heart and what you do. And so as we brainstormed, it was kind of like, oh, you know, what's kind of a neat symbolic way to show that on a cover? And we thought about the Wizard of Oz and the Tin Man. Because
yes,
the Tin
needed
Man
a heart.
Needed a heart and did a little research and found out that we had access to some interesting costumes, and so did the whole nine yards, and I was Dorothy, and
the killer costume was the Dorothy costume.
You think so?
Got that, yeah. Jenna, who works with us, she was able to get that from her family, and it was, like, spot on.
It was.
And, of course, we put our own slant on it instead of the ruby red slippers.
I had my red Chuck Taylors, got through an escape plan challenge, actually.
Yeah. And instead of Toto.
Yeah. Of course, we had the real Stinky, so it's kind of neat that the real Stinky would be
made an appearance.
On,
yeah,
on the cover.
And so then I was the Tin Man, and that was quite the hunt to try to find the right suit, because
there are some pretty cheesy Tin Man suits out there.
Well, I didn't realize. It's been a while since I've seen the show, the movie, but I don't remember that the Tin Man wore spandex.
Well,
do you remember that?
No, I don't either, but there was a costume.
Apparently, there was one somewhere, because there was a lot of spandex Tin Man costumes. And
yeah.
I'm not sure where that came from. So I was not about to get into any spandex. But the one we found was pretty good.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of Photoshop work on that to make it look even more tinny.
Tinny, I guess. Because it wasn't tinny.
Did the Photoshop to make my face look silver, instead of having to go through all the goopy makeup, which never quite looks right anyway. So,
yeah.
And, you know, that was one of the little extra benefits for Club K&J members, where we put up a link with a password-protected page that had basically the step-by-step of how we created the photo with all of the different techniques. So that was one of the little side benefits. And we invite all of you listeners to, you know, if you're one of those people who loves this whole concept of being childlike, and if you kind of feel like sometimes you're out on an island and everyone else around you has adultitis, Club K&J is for you.
Definitely.
It's never been a better time to join. You get a 25% discount for all lemonade stand orders. Of course, you get the paper magazines, every issue sent right to your door, and all these other little kind of fun things. So definitely check out Club K&J. Join the revolution. We love to have you. We're always doing cool stuff. So I guess that's the update, what we've been up to lately, besides all the crazy speaking around the country.
There it is, the holy grail of Christmas gifts, the Red Ryder 200 shot range model air rifle.
Now here's something we hope you'll really like.
That is so cool.
Cool.
Oh, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
All right, the cool thing is something that I totally fell in love with as soon as I saw it. Okay, we all grew up, well, not we all, because today's kids don't, but many of us in our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s above grew up with the cassette tape, right? After the
8-track and the vinyl, the albums.
And before CDs, you had the tape, you know, and the mixtape was often a big thing.
Deal.
You know, you make a mixtape for a road trip or to give to the special someone with all those special songs on there that you handpick and try to record.
Perfect order.
Try to record off the radio and the DJ talks and you're like, no, you know. And but anyway, we found this audio cassette bag. It's like a tote bag that looks like a big audio cassette.
Ever since we saw this, you were late. You were lobbying hard to get this
in
our store.
It's like, we need this bag because anyone who is the child of the 80s knows that cassette tapes were a major part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of like wear it loud and proud, and everybody needs a tote bag to throw junk into. So it's one of my favorite cool things that we have.
And it's neat because the handles are brown, and so they look like the tape that's actually coming out. You know how sometimes they get
do you know
tangled up or whatever.
How bad that would be when your tape would like unravel, and then you're sitting there with a pencil trying
to.
Yeah, terrible.
Those were the days, weren't they?
So anyway, check it out. It's just a fun gift for any of those Gen Xers out there.
Yep. Okay, it is time to reveal the Mindbender question, which was: what was the original color of Oscar the Grouch in the first episode of Sesame Street? Kim, what did you say?
I said blue.
You said blue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, the answer is yellow.
Yellow.
Oscar the Grouch was actually yellow.
What?
And the reason they changed, there were two reasons that they changed him. Because I know you always, when I tell you what the answer is, you want more information. So
you're learning.
I dug a little deeper.
Yay.
First off, there was another yellow character that was on the show by the name of Big Bird. May have heard of him. The producers of Sesame Street did not want it to appear that they only had yellow characters.
Okay.
I guess that would be a bad thing, apparently. secondly, it was argued that a character that lived in a garbage can would not be a bright yellow color.
Okay.
The character would have to be a darker color since he lived in garbage.
Sure.
A lot of thought went into this, right? The producers went to work to change Oscar the Grouch's color. The first color they came up with was orange. Oscar was orange for almost the entire first month of taping.
Huh.
Then one day, someone came up with the idea of changing his color to green. This idea for the color of Oscar is what we have grown up with.
Yeah.
So he went through a couple color changes there. I'm wondering why brown wasn't the obvious choice. I mean,
garbage.
Maybe they didn't want...
I don't know.
They wanted to liven it up a little bit, I guess. But
green
there you go.
Green is a good color. I can't imagine
Works
him
out
any other color.
Pretty good, yeah. So there you go. Oscar the Grouch was originally yellow. And then orange, before he became
green. And then green.
Yeah.
What's up, Doc? Now, this won't hurt a bit.
For this month's prescription, we're going to go back old school on you. It's kind of a two-parter. The first thing is to find an old episode of Sesame Street and watch it.
Ooh.
Okay, so I don't know if you still find it current show, or go and rent, because they have some of the older ones out on DVD. Just watch it and kind of like just let it whisk you back to the times where things were simpler and things, people just got along and all that stuff. And then hopefully with that, then you'll be inspired to go out and do something nice for a child.
Mm.
And you know, like talking to Bob, it was really cool just to hear about how the things that they did really impacted kids and all of us growing up in some ways in very amazing and profound ways. And so you never know how those little things that you do for a kid can make a big difference. And so while we focus on escaping adulthood, one of the best ways to escape adulthood is to be with kids and to do something nice for them. And it always ends up that you get way, way more back in return than whatever you put out there. So that's our prescription.
Well, that's it for today's show. Be sure to check out escapeadulthood.com for today's show notes featuring links to some of the things we talked about here today. For Jason, this is Kim signing off from Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks for listening. And remember, it's never too late to have a second childhood.
It's a little childish and stupid, but then so is high school.